Hello, this is John Sifferman from physicalliving.com, and today I have a very special guest to introduce to you. Her name is Dr. Julie Angel, and she is an author, a filmmaker, and a photographer who has spent many years studying and practicing parkour, MoveNat, and some other movement and fitness disciplines. And this was a really fascinating interview. Julie got like into not just the surface level stuff, but some of the really deep aspects of parkour in particular. I learned a lot. I found it fascinating and eye-opening, and I think you're going to really enjoy it. So I'm going to stop blabbing and get right to the interview. I hope you enjoy it. So could we start by just having you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and what you do today?
Yeah, sure. So hi, I'm Julie. So I'm from the southwest of England, originally a town called city called Plymouth, and I'm currently based in the US. And I guess as far as what I do, I kind of wear many hats in terms of, I've been in the creative industries for the last kind of 25 years in various capacities of being doing everything from fine art, experimental animation, installations, a brief period as a video jockey, but then mainly as a documentary filmmaker, and really loving a very natural observational style where I'm basically invisible and I become this sort of translator between what I see and then what the audience gets at the end. And then in more recent years, I've really enjoyed photography a lot more. And I think maybe it's just I got fed up of dealing with large video files. I don't know. And the time it takes me to edit a film is huge compared to being able to go to a shoot and then turn around a large body of work photographically. So I enjoy that kind of the reward of what I can share, I guess. And then basically as a product for the last 12 years or so, a lot of my I did a practice-based PhD which combined documentary filmmaking and documenting and understanding parkour. So that was what really led to me accessing and understanding and participating in different movement cultures in different ways. And then also I wrote a book again as a product of those adventures within parkour. So the book's called Breaking the Jump, and that was published in the UK and the US last June. And then really for the last kind of 6 months, year, even though I've been doing it informally before that, I've sort of stepping out behind the camera a little bit and sharing my movement journey and becoming a movement coach. And so through the See and Do project, which I started a few years ago, I'm offering workshops and an online course just for people who really want to move better and feel better. And to do that, there's this dichotomy and understanding between mind and body. So it's really sort of train the mind, train the body, and all of that is the product of a lot of things that I've experienced over the last 12 years or so, really.
Mm-hmm. And all of that is the reason why I wanted to get on the phone with you for an hour and just talk movement, talk training, because, you know, yeah, you wear a lot of hats, and it seems like you're stepping into this role of still very much an artist, but also an innovator, and sharing some things you've learned over these years of doing parkour and MoveNat. So that's awesome. And you got your PhD and you did your thesis on parkour. That is awesome. Like, how did you swing that? Like, that's the coolest thesis ever.
Well, it's funny because it didn't seem anything unusual to me at the time. And recently, and perhaps here in the States, a lot of movement people I speak to are kind of like, wow, how is that possible? And I mean, my discovery of parkour was a continuation from a project I'd done with a really amazing filmmaker called Milan Spasic. And we were at art college together. And then after art college, I helped him out with a project called Chlorine, which was about pool skaters in Southern California. And seeing how these guys combine, and this was kind of the, it was a current, at the time, current day look at how a lot of the kind of old school or original, like Dogtown and the Z-Boys guys, how they were still out there. They were still searching pools, draining them, riding pipes, you know, having a lot of fun and connecting to their environment in that way. So the way that they combined their own physicality with this creative vision of their environment was really interesting to me. And I saw them, I mean, they were artists and rebels. I mean, without a doubt, like there's really, there's a lot of subtle differences and some very larger differences between those skaters and the parkour world. But my transition into the parkour world started by documenting pool skaters in Southern California. Mm-hmm. And then when I got back to the UK after doing that, I became really interested in visual anthropology. So visual anthropology is basically, it's like documentary filmmaking and photography with ethics, because you do this long-term field work where you become, or you find a role within the community that you're documenting so that you can understand it from both the insider perspective, but you remain outside so that you can document it for others outside who can then understand it. So you're constantly insider, outsider, insider, outsider. So those two things, I basically just fell so much in love with visual anthropology, like I couldn't get enough of it. And I also loved the theory behind it. And I wasn't particularly kind of in the books when I was at art college. I was really just, my energy was just, I just want to make stuff. I want to make things. I was really a practical artist. But suddenly, like, I liked reading about these French philosophers. I loved Foucault. I liked Lefebvre. I loved Desautures. And it just kind of, it was a moment in life where all those pieces came together. And then at the same time, parkour appeared on a BBC One channel ident in the UK with David Bell in a short film called Rush Hour. And I mean, it's still to this day, it's a beautifully crafted piece of film. And it's so, the film is so beautifully crafted and David's movements are so perfectly executed that it actually doesn't look real. And there was actually a lot of, at the time in the UK, the BBC put out all the, you know, the, it was quite a phenomena at the time. People were like, wow, there is a real life Spider-Man. Like, oh my God, that's amazing. And then, so the BBC even put out lots of information saying like, no, these stunts are real. And this man did jump from this rooftop to this rooftop. And he took that landing and he did this and did that. And so that was my first kind of, that's when parkour kind of appeared on my radar. And then not that long after, Mike Christie and Mike Smith, a filmmaking team, made a documentary for Channel 4, another British television channel, called Jump London. So I'd been studying visual anthropology. I was aware of parkour. I was so excited about this documentary. And I saw it and it was, I mean, it's a beautiful television documentary. And but because I'd already started wearing this anthropologist hat, I was kind of like, oh, but where's the everyday? Where's the... What's the thinking beyond the spectacle, behind the jump? What is it to be that person? The person who goes outside and does that, what do they think when they wake up? How do they see the world? That's what was of interest to me. And I basically wanted to continue my visual anthropology, so I started looking for different MAs and masters in London at the time. And I had a meeting at Brunel University with a professor there, and... and again, like, I'm still a very practical filmmaker at this moment. I'm starting to enjoy, you know, the longest essay I'd ever written was 1,000 words at that time. And I had this meeting with this amazing professor, and I told him the filmmaking I'd been involved in. I told him about my evening classes in visual anthropology at SOAS, which is a really amazing institution in the UK. It's sort of one of the oldest universities establishments. It's the School of African and the School of Oriental and African Studies. And the quality of anthropology there is just kind of, it's just wow. It's just like the most intellectually stimulating environment you can step into. And basically, Mike Wayne, this professor, just said, well, have you ever thought of doing a PhD? And I was kind of like, no, that's ridiculous. I like making films. And then he made me aware of this opportunity to do both practice and theory and bring together the elements of filmmaking, theorizing what I was documenting, and also my style of filmmaking. So that really appealed. And I wrote a proposal, and the simple guidelines were anything you've ever been interested in and that continues on your previous work. So this is where the pool skating led to parkour, and there was supposed to be some other kind of urban, unregulated, creative physical practices. So at the time, there was quite a sort of subculture of urban golf happening in London. There was bouldering and speed climbing and stuff like that. But as soon as I started to scratch the surface of parkour, it was like, wow, there's so much here. This is, and you know, to this day, I mean, my PhD was the first one to look at parkour. And since then, there's four others have been completed. And there's two others that are in process at the moment. And both of their focus is on parkour and how it relates to mental health, which is intriguing and fascinating and important. So it was just a kind of like a sports anthropology study. So any culture or any activity within a culture can be looked at from an anthropological perspective. So it's what do those people do? How do they think? And then what knowledge can be gained by other people from understanding and looking at that? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of, so like I did like the anthropology of parkour and used filmmaking as a tool to ask questions to the parkour athletes and for me to answer them and then show them those answers and then make another film and make another film, and make another film. So that was, I mean, you know, there's PhDs on how Amazonian tribes play football. And, you know, so it's kind of in sports anthropology and cultural anthropology, it's kind of not a weird one, but from a fitness perspective, it's like the word PhD and the word parkour don't seem like natural bedfellows, but,
sure, yeah.
Think they can be. It's good.
Yeah, that is so cool. You're definitely a trailblazer. Other people are following in your footsteps. I think that's awesome. I hope that some of the people listening to this will do what you did and follow their heart and dream big and see where the trail takes them. So
thank you.
So I want to talk mostly about parkour because I've never really done anything on parkour. On my website, I've never done parkour. I've been a big MoveNet supporter and enthusiast for years and years, but parkour is kind of a world that's foreign to me. And so, you know, I guess we'll start is like in your own words, what is parkour, and in the same breath, like what is it not? Because, you know, I imagine there's a lot more to it than just running and jumping and balancing in urban environments, which is how it's often portrayed. So just, you know, I just want to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, sure. And it's something that, you know, there's a kind of simple, there are the simple answers, there's the deep answers, there's the theoretical answers. And I mean, my personal conclusions after the PhD was, and I kept thinking, like, I'm going to come up with something really clever, like really, really clever. It's going to be really deep and really clever. And what I concluded was something actually a lot more simple. So from the outside, from the exterior perspective, from an outside perspective, parkour is a training methodology to improve yourself physically and mentally by overcoming obstacles, which can be both real and imagined. So there's the physical obstacle, the wall, but then you also have the movement is an emotional practice. And so you have the emotional aspects, which can include things like joy, excitement, thrill, but equally fear, frustration, anger, ego, all of those kind of things as well. So you have to overcome various emotional obstacles to do it. And this process of finding ways to move in different routes, which is like probably the most generalized, you know, lots of people have this like parkour, A to B, you know, as efficient as you can. It's kind of like, I mean, it is that. And it's a whole lot more than that. So finding ways to move your body through a terrain, and it can be as equally in nature as it is in the urban. And the issue was that it was, it seems a lot more kind of, quote, natural for people to play in nature. And the sites where parkour is practiced in an urban domain aren't generally perceived, and it's not viewed as normal to move in those ways in those environments, which is why it becomes spectacular, why there's an implicit politics to those acts, why it's seen as anarchic, it's seen as rebellious, it's seen as alarming to a lot of people. Yet if someone were doing the same actions, climbing a tree and doing on that, it's like, oh yeah, poof, it's play. Yeah, like, oh, it's kind of like high level play, or it's really risky play, or like, wow, that person must be really scared. But you change the tree for a building, and there's a different set of rules that we've been socialized to conform to. So it's seen as a non-conformist movement practice, yet the movements, when translated in different environments, are the same. So from the outside, that's how parkour can look. But it's actually, it's a very internal emotional practice, although it has this heightened physicality to it. Because we never saw from the beginning the 20 years of training. What we saw at the beginning was 20 years later. So it was kind of just like, wow, we see amazing movement. We see new definitions of what the human body can take. The fact that, okay, this person can go two stories up high and drop to the ground on concrete, on asphalt, and do a roll and get up and be fine. And none of these guys are, none of the founders, none of them are broken. They're all in physically good shape. Some of them are stronger now than they were 10 years ago. So it really redefined a set of ideas that we had of not just what the body can do, but what can be done and where it can be done and how it can be done. And also a lot of the time, it takes quite a mixed skill set to communicate those things. So the physical abilities were communicated by us seeing them, but the understanding and the training and the emotional impact of what it takes to do that and what processes are occurring, it's not necessarily the same group of people who have that vocabulary to do that, or the opportunity to do that, or depending who those people were. And you have to remember, the founders were from like some of the suburbs of Paris. They were this highly multicultural group who carried mainly negative stereotypes within the French media. So it was actually the UK that kind of went like, this is an art. There is a philosophy. This should be valued. Whereas in France, it was kind of like, oh, it's those guys from over there. Mm-hmm. No one's going to listen to them. I mean, there were, you know, people like Luc Besson got their attention from the physicality of it. But as far as allowing them to be the authors, allowing them to have their voice, to share the ideas, that's a whole kind of other story. So for me, parkour is an introverted emotional practice. To get physically stronger is the sort of first 7-8 years and is relatively straightforward. Then what maintains people and what is really of interest is the emotional practice. And that is the constant seeking out challenges, finding things that create this emotional response of fear and making friends with it. And also having this humility to know that what you did on one day may not dictate what you can do on another day. So a lot of things we do, you can kind of bring excuses into the mix, like, oh, well, I didn't have my best shoes, I didn't have this, I wasn't warmed up, I wasn't training, I wasn't this, I wasn't that. I mean, we all have our kind of list of like why I didn't perform that day. And what parkour is about is really this thing that every time you go out to train and you seek those challenges and you get to see who you are in that moment. And this is why, I mean, I wrote in my thesis quite a lot about flow state, and that's kind of become a new trendy thing of like, it used to be mindfulness and now it's flow state. And I don't know what the next kind of wellness keyword buzzword will be, but it's always interesting. So, I mean, when you're going to, I don't know, do something that's just above your comfort zone, just out of it, but within your own capabilities, you can engage with a very real sense of what you're made of in that moment in time. So whilst parkour has this creative imagination of how you interpret your landscape and the opportunities you see within it, so, you know, the picnic table isn't just a picnic table. That's something to move over, to move under, to traverse around, to balance on, to, you know, have this multitude of variants of things that you can do with it. that picnic table is also, depending on what you choose to do, will provide a mirror back on you to reflect who you are at that moment in time. Are you tired? Are you strong? Are you able? Are you confident? Are you fearful? And it's that engagement with the emotional process that I believe is kind of where the magic lies in parkour, because you get this, and it also basically parkour is a kind of reveal and heal system. So it reveals your weaknesses, and by doing it, it heals them. So, and because it has this kind of emotional thing, you get to see who you are, and also you get to achieve things that you actually never thought were possible. And if you can start to see other things, not just as they are and in a very limited capacity, that also reflects back onto your own self-image and your own view of where you fit and connect into the world. And by having this very tactile physical relationship with the environment, you then connect to that environment, which is also why I think, I mean, a lot of people train in a lot of different terrains, and there's, for a while, there was, you know, like, should parkour be trained inside or just outside? And I mean, talk to my friends in Finland in the winter, and they have very different views on, like, well, yeah, they do train outside sometimes, but you know what? It's really nice to train inside when you're in the Finnish winter. But I also believe that there's a different level of magic that happens when you're outside, and it's this connecting to the world outside, that world that you navigate and move through. And how you find a place in it. Because when you go to a spot and train, you get lost in it. And this is a bit of kind of flow state, which is basically just the phenomenology of enjoyment. You get lost in something that you love doing. And that then makes that space kind of yours for that little moment of time, whether it's like 20 minutes balancing on a rail or just going like, okay, so this no longer becomes like, there was an area in London that I used to walk home through sometimes, and I used to think of it as a really dodgy estate. I always felt on edge. I never felt easy there. I felt quite vulnerable. I didn't like walking through this thing, but I would take the shortcut sometimes, or I'd have to go to the underground wasn't working properly, and I'd have to take this route. And then it turned out that this estate was actually one of the areas where some of the parkour classes would happen. And I fell in love with this estate. Suddenly, it wasn't a site of vulnerability for me. It was a site of discovery and explanation. And it was like, I would walk through and go, oh, that wall's so cool, because it has this gradient. So I can start off here and like warm up and do a really nice, comfortable jump. And then halfway up, it starts to get a bit more tricky, but it's really gradual. I can adapt around it, and that will achieve this result for me and that result for me. And I never to that day felt uneasy at any time, day or night, walking through that estate again. So I'd changed, by changing my relationship with my environment, I'd changed something about me as well. And I think that's one of the really key and healthy tools and benefits of parkour. Massively long and distracted, rambling answer.
No, that was all, you know, the take home message for me is that there is so much more to parkour than what a lot of people might perceive. You know, so many people only see the tip of the iceberg, and I think the more that you immerse yourself in any deep movement art, whether it's parkour or MoveNat or a martial art or dance or whatever, the more layers that you get to dig. And, you know, it has to be experienced to be understood. And some things might take years. Like you mentioned, you know, the first 7 years is just mostly physical training, you know, building the body. And then you know, that's like when you earn your black belt, and then you suddenly see all the possibilities, right?
Oh yeah, I mean you're still having those emotional experiences within it, but there is a preoccupation with, you know, what am I physically capable of? But if you talk to people who've been doing this for over 20 years, no one's interested in how high they can jump, how far they can jump, how long they can balance for, how long the traverses they can do. Like that's kind of boring. Yeah. So my question like was, well, what does hold you? What does keep you motivated? And the answer that kept coming back was I wanted to see what I could do beyond my limits. So that's an emotional limit as well as a physical one. Can I control my emotions? And then, you know, yeah, just what am I capable of? And what does, they all wanted to be strong. And it's like, but that's a really loaded word. And so what does strong mean? So, and this is why I always say that parkour is a culture of effort. And this is something I really promote with the See and Do project. And there are so many things within the parkour world where, for example, when I started researching it, there was no YouTube. There weren't phone cameras. There wasn't. So the parkour that I saw was big, shiny, high-end film production and television production. And then I started making my documentary films. Then suddenly YouTube appeared, and I was an early kind of member of YouTube, as most people in the film community were. Like, it was suddenly like, we have these short films, and the only place you could really put them anywhere was either film festivals, or you had a distribution deal where they showed them like on airplanes as the, you know, the primer before the main film. So, and then, you know, Web 2.0 comes along. Phone technology changes, cameras become shaped. This whole thing is democratized, which is actually, I think, as a filmmaker, I think this is a really beautiful thing. You don't need to, you know, take out a mortgage on a house to buy a camera and make something with a decent quality. It's the ideas that matter. It's the meaning that you communicate that matters now, which is fantastic. However, parkour is spectacular. And this is a contradiction and a paradox, and it's its strength and weakness all in one. It looks beautiful. It is amazing. It is spectacular. People are drawn to that. People want to see that. Filmmakers who go and document it, whether it's a student film project or whether it's a commercial or it's whatever, no one's interested on the low-level, tricky jump that messes with your mind, that's from one tree branch to another, that's slightly around the corner. All the edges are unbalanced. You can't quite see the landing. There's something where you have to duck halfway through it, and you know, that's not gonna sell a new mobile phone contract. That's not gonna make you buy a pair of trainers. And unless you come from that embodied movement practice yourself in whatever field, there's no appreciation of that. There's no value to that. So we are a society of the spectacle, and we love that. And there's so many people who are celebrating that, and there's a role for that because it inspires. I mean, I was inspired. My issue is that we just see a small portion. And it's not just that we see a small portion of the activity. We also have a very small representation of who is doing it as well. Whereas... So, for example, the female parkour community was really small when I started. I knew like five other women in the world at the time. Like, I was one of them, and I was just like, I hadn't moved for 20 years. I was scared of everything, and but I had access to people who were willing to share their time and knowledge with me, and I had a relationship with them because I'd already been documenting them for 6 months. So what was accessible to me was not accessible to other people I knew who were the same as me. So, you know, there's a lot of psychological studies, and there's evidence out there. And, you know, you just kind of look, you don't have to look very far to know that, you know, sometimes you need to see it to be it. You need to see someone else do something, and you have a physical empathy with that person in some way. And you think like, wow, if that person can do it, then it's possible for me to start learning. Whether you think you'll ever get to that thing, but you can start to have a reality of engaging with that process. So you need to see it to be it. And that's kind of where See and Do came into play, which is this idea of like, see is for inspiration and do is for action. So I started celebrating and sharing lots of pictures at the beginning of women doing parkour, because I was seeing them in the access that I had, the events I was going to. But then if I looked around at images from the parkour world, within like different parkour companies, parkour gyms, I look at it and it's like, well, if I was a newcomer and I came here, I just think that it's only guys from maybe 14 to 21 who train parkour.
Yeah, right.
And that's nothing bad. And it's fantastic that guys of that age group are training it. And that's amazing. But let's not uninvite all the others. And there's the default of our Western society is when it comes to especially highly physical sporting practices that involve risk and bravery and effort in such an obvious sense, the default is male. So you can't just say, everyone's welcome. And then all you show is images of young guys and the words, everyone is welcome. It just kind of doesn't cut it. So as a filmmaker and photographer, I was kind of thinking, like, you know, when I started to look at it, I was like, yeah, that kind of, that's a real shame. There's something missing there. And then I had to ask myself, well, why haven't I been documenting that? What am, if I have, I'm a visual anthropologist, I'm a filmmaker, I'm a photographer, I have this awareness, I have access. If I'm not celebrating that, then why should I be expecting and encouraging others? So that was kind of born out of that, really.
Yeah. And obviously, parkour has changed a lot. I'm sure the originators, you know, they've developed, they've adapted. Obviously, it's become commercialized in some ways, and it's very different than it used to be. And a lot of people think, when they think of parkour, they think exactly what you said. It's young teenage boys or young men, and that's what seems to dominate most of the YouTube video sensations. But it is very diverse, and there are a lot of women doing it now. And one thing I wanted to ask you is, do you believe that parkour is a young person's sport? I know it's not a sport, but I can't think of a better
word. Yeah, no, a practice, yeah. No, not at all. And actually, there's some really amazing projects that have been happening over the last few years to address that. And, you know, there's something that one of the founders, Williams Bell, always says that I really like. And he says, you know, everyone can do parkour, but parkour is not for everyone. So in the same way that we could all play the piano, but some people may resonate with drums, some people may want the cello, some people may want a synthesizer and sampler. But can everyone do parkour? Yes, absolutely. Does it invite you? No. If you kind of look around, and also it's very young. I mean, none of this is anyone's fault or anything. It's a very young discipline, and it's a product of the culture that it was created in, and it's a lived culture. It is evolving, it's changing, and so it's not kind of like, well, this was the original dojo and this is how it stays and these are the rules and the lines. It was a lived culture, and it continues to be lived and formed and changed by those who are experiencing it and sharing it in different ways. There's a kind of disproportionate number of voices and what we see and what we hear. As with any discipline and its formative kind of growth years, really. So there's a project that started in the UK called Forever Young, and that was a good friend of mine, Jade Shaw, mixed parkour, kind of dance therapy, other movement practices, and she focused on working with people 60 years plus and training with them in parks. And it was as much about tackling social isolation in senior years as the, you know, the important skills of, you know, if you may maintain your ability and belief in that you can balance, you're far less likely to fall. And if you do fall, if you've been training parkour, you're far more able and have the autonomy to get up from the fall, to get up from the floor, to have this autonomous, independent living, as well as engaging with the kind of social side. And there's a project here in the US which has just been launched called PK Silver by Nancy Lorenz. And she's actually created a curriculum for coaches to work with seniors, so 60 plus. And I mean, a lot of parkour coaches are really excited for Nancy to start sharing that a lot more. I've run classes where I don't put any age group. I'm really a big fan of intergenerational training. And I regularly have people in their late 50s, 60s. And what I've learned is, what, don't have an expectation of what you think this individual can do. And just invite them. Invite them to move and invite them and give them the responsibility for their autonomy. I think what you say and how you relate, that these are emotional practices, not just physical practices, and that it's important for people to be in their own bodies. I mean, someone can turn up and the coach can ask them, like, what injuries do you have? And you have this and that. And experienced coaches can look at them and say, well, I can see that, you know, from, you know, you don't have to do an FMS assessment. You can kind of see how some people are moving or how they approach the first baby step that you give them. And then, you know, you need to unless, because with parkour, you're a lot of the time you're taking people out of their comfort zone. You have to make them comfortable to go out of the comfort zone. They have to know that they are supported if they're going to do that. So I've seen so many emotional breakdowns when people have been training parkour, and generally from people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. The older ones, emotionally, they've been through a lot in life, and they're having new experiences, and they know how to be brave. And there's a lot of things in life where circumstances don't directly ask us to be brave. And I think it's a really healthy thing to do that, and how you embrace risk and how that translates from, you know, the emotional tools you use to get over the picnic table are the same emotional tools that you can apply to dealing with your landlord, dealing with the potential of losing your job, dealing with the loss of this, the loss of that. So that can translate. So, and also, you know, I mean, I'm 47, training, getting stronger. One of my close friends, Kiko, who I train with, she's 58. And I mean, she's teaching young guys parkour. She takes big drops, she does big stuff. And so for me, it's exciting. I now have a reference of like, wow, in 11 years time, I could be moving like Kiko. So I've seen it to be it. It's see and do. And I think that, and this kind of is a message I know that MoveNat has shared a lot, is that, you know, we are all able and all have a right to continue in our lives to be strong and healthy and able and have this autonomy. But yeah, you're not going to see the, you know, because those kind of non-dominant groups of participants within parkour, they're not particularly interested in going on YouTube. It's a personal practice, and there's also on Facebook there's a nice group that I'm part of, you know, it's called like Parkour Over 40s group, and we're all sharing videos and our training things, and you know, the ego of youth is something that, you know, people are like, no one's interested, and it's a very supportive environment, and we share training ideas, and for me it's just lovely. Like now, like I just know a whole bunch of women who are in their 50s training parkour, and like, wow, my god, they're amazing. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I want more people to see them, so, you know, I share them on the See and Do website and on the blog and things like that, and what's beautiful is the young people in the parkour world are equally as excited about that. They have a reference for their future. It's a lot further away than my future, but they're equally excited. And so I think that's a really positive thing. So, you know, what is one person's parkour is, you know, potentially different from another. But if you make it a culture of effort, if you recognize it as this physical yet internal practice, then there's a place for everyone. And, you know, the elite level athletes, the elite level athletes who, you know, who are continuing to break new ground with what they're doing, and I like, I mean, I watch it and I'm like, wow, that's amazing. But it doesn't speak to me. It doesn't touch me in the way that the 52-year-old woman does, the 58-year-old woman does, because I have no physical empathy with the young guy who's doing that thing. It's kind of like, you know, I go to watch Cirque du Soleil and I just go like, wow, it's amazing. But there isn't that personal potential investment within it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I think that is just so cool how you've been able to describe parkour. It's a whole body practice. And so much of how people, I think, just initially think of it on the surface is that it's about fitness, it's about movement. But really, any good training is a whole person experience. It's your mindset, mental training, and emotional training, and spiritual training, and it takes the whole person. It's a real integral approach, and I'm glad that you spoke to that, because it's not spoken of often enough. And that's where I think, like you mentioned before, so many people, they may start parkour for the physical reasons, you know, like they want to get in shape, or they want to be more confident in their skin or feel and move better, but they stay with it for all these years because they like, wow, the rewards just keep coming on deeper and deeper levels. So I think that's really cool.
And also, I mean, you know, it has to be said as well, like, I mean, the physical side of it, you'll get strong. You will get stronger than you have ever thought possible. And it's because it is whole body and it's functional in a whole body sense. And so you will age well, you know, if you don't, you know, if you train smart and you listen to your body, and parkour kind of encourages to that. And so you will get physically strong in a very practical way. And it's fun. Like, even if you just turn up and you go, do you know what? I've got no idea what she's talking about, but I just like kind of doing a bit of jumping and balancing and climbing stuff. And like, and it's like, yeah, it is. It is. Yeah. It is that. And it should be fun. And there should be, it shouldn't all be pain and angst and this search for your, this quest for your authentic identity. I mean, it is all of those things, but it's also play and fun and fear, and you know, the walls are your toys. They're there for you, and how you engage in your landscape. So it is physical, it is fun, and this is why it's a very multi-dimensional practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And I think it's great what you're doing and what so many are doing, getting the older generations involved, because you know, the generation over 50, over 60, and the older you go, they're really the forgotten people. You know, it's everything today is geared towards the younger people, and it's new and it's hip, and we need more people leading that over 50 crowd, say, hey, look what you can do. You know, it's empowering, and as you said, there's so many benefits to this philosophy, this way of life. So you mentioned earlier, I think, that you had lived a sedentary lifestyle for like 20 years, and so That's news to me. So I kind of just assumed, okay, Julie Angel, she's been this parkour master for like the last couple decades or whatever. But can you talk a little bit?
No.
So you weren't always a buildering, move matting, elite parkour tracer. No. So what was your life like before this stuff? And like, how have things changed since? You know, you can keep your answer under 5 hours. That would be great. But I just want to kind of hear a before and after, you know, like.
Yeah, I mean, I was, my story is no different than many. It's really average. It's the predictable one. I was a sporty teenager up until age 15, 16. I was captain of the netball team. I was into swimming. I did athletics for my city. And then I stopped, and I never consciously made that decision. I just was distracted with college and socializing and friends. But what's really interesting is that I still maintained this idea that part of my identity was sporty, but it wasn't. And just because I knew people who surfed and skated, like I was sort of like, yeah, I'm kind of hanging out with active people. So I was sporty. I was never overweight. So I looked sporty. And I wasn't. I went to college. I did sound engineering, not much physicality to that. Sat down, recording bands, playing with funny sounds and pictures. You know, went back to art college again, did, you know, kind of film school stuff. You have a few days when you're active and you're carrying equipment on film sets. The rest of the time, you're sitting down, you're editing. Life, a lot of sitting. I didn't actively do any sports. And then when I came to do my first parkour class, I mean, it physically destroyed me like nothing has ever destroyed me since. And I also remember going on a video shoot with some of the guys, and I was sat in the car next to them, and we were really squashed in, and I was aware that like their legs were pressing against mine, and it was like, my God, they're like bricks. Like these guys are made of cement, and just everything was soft. You know, I was skinny fat, you know, and I had no strength, and I'd been sat down for 20 years, and I didn't know that I had accumulated so much physical fear and lack of ability in my body in those 20 years, because it had never been called into question. You can live a comfortable, conformist life. You look like this, you do that, you think like, well, if I needed to do that, I could. But actually, yeah, I couldn't. I couldn't have, you know, run for 10 minutes. I'm like, my God, I hated running. Like, I hated it. And I was so unable of so many things. And, you know, I did step vaults for 7 years. I stepped over things. I was in classes where people jumped over stuff and they vaulted over stuff, and I didn't. And I had coaches that were really encouraging. And I mean, I remember the first time I like did one type of vault over something. And I remember my coach just going like, whoa, Julie, oh my God, do it again, do it again. And I think I was so excited as well. And so all that really matters is that, are you moving forward? So I've been training for 12 years and it's steady and it's cool, and I train for me. I like, for years and years, I would never show anybody anything, because it's no one else's business what I can and can't do. I never made claims to do anything, and I still don't. And also, there was a really big change for me. I was a vegetarian for 20 years, and so I was also, you know, training, you know, three times a week, and just not getting any stronger and I actually had quite a lot of injuries, and it was because I was injured, and I wasn't injured from parkour. I was actually injured from film shoots I was walking in Tokyo for like 4 days wearing canvas all-stars that didn't bend, and jet lag and heat, and my Achilles were just destroyed, and injuries weren't healing. I had a lot of stress doing the PhD. I mean, the filmmaking part was fun, but writing a thesis is just hard, and a kind of quite monastic, miserable time of life. And I then introduced fish into my diet. I became stronger. When I became stronger, I could recover better. I could train more. And then a few years after that, I introduced meat into my diet, and my strength tripled. And I also, you know, like did the sort of paleo thing alongside that. So when I started eating fish again, and what it meant was just that I didn't have recovery time. Like there was just like, I could go out, I could train, I move, boom, next day I feel good. And there was always this sort of exhaustion that happened before when I trained. It wouldn't be like, oh, my arms, and like, oh, I have a pain or an ache here, I've pulled this muscle. It was just like, I have no energy. I just, like, from 4 o'clock onwards to the next day, it's like, I just want to lie on my bed and eat ice cream. That's all I feel like doing. I mean, I wouldn't eat ice cream all the time. Some ice cream, yes. But that's my personal experience. That was my body and what worked for me and changed for me. And then, and actually, you know, training MoveNet had a really big impact on me as well, because I learned a lot of efficient techniques that I wasn't aware of before. For those who are the natural athletes, for those who are the stronger, they kind of get to that route a lot quicker without that kind of guided instruction. But for me, it made a huge difference. So there were a lot of changes altogether. There was the, you know, they say you can't exercise out a bad diet. And also, you know, the fuel you give your body can change it. And for me, that was a really big change. And, you know, I never thought I'd ever be able to do a pull-up. And then, you know, you find you can do many. And it's, and, you know, now my training is just like, I move every day. I do something. Like, I have no, sometimes I have goals, sometimes I don't. Sometimes I just enjoy doing the things that I do. I love moving outside and sharing that with other people. It's great that I have, like, people that inspire me that I can go and train with and move with, and, you know, and when I'm sharing movement, I mean, my God, I learn from every student. I learn from every participant. There's something to be gained there. And I just believe that we're all able. And I think because I had so many emotional blocks, Like I had blocks being taught how to like run up a wall. I was like, you want me to run at that wall? Are you insane? Like not one cell in my body wants to do that. You're a lunatic. Like that is not, you know, part of me was just like, that's not going to happen. And then part of me would be like, I really want to run up that wall. That's going to be amazing to run up that wall. And I just think it is an amazing thing. Like, so I share great excitement with training people how to run up walls. And it's just a great achievement. And with a few techniques, like many, 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 many people can run up walls without any training in very much. So, you know, there's a kind of like, there's no secret training methods. There's questions of quality to the movement. There's a question of repetitions. I really believe in this kind of, my friend Mary Beth taught it to me from this kind of like greasing the groove idea of, you know, having these healthy movement patterns. You start to train something, your form goes to shit. Oh, stop it. Don't ingrain those patterns. Don't destroy your body. But it's also a process of learning. I mean, at the beginning, I didn't really know when I was pushing myself when, okay, is that a physical ache or is it a pain where I'm damaging myself? I didn't have that body awareness. So again, you know, I kind of learned the hard way in a lot of things. So it'd be like, oh, now I can't move my elbows for 2 weeks or because I was warmed up and I was doing something. And I was like, oh, well, I just thought it was an effort thing. So, I think a lot of people underestimate the influence of the mental process involved in this, of the language that we use about our own abilities, the language that coaches use, how challenges are presented to us. And it's also kind of individual as well. I mean, I did one workshop where I was told like, well, if you can do X, Y, and Z, you go over there. And if you can't and you're weak, you go in that group. And I mean, it was actually like so the opposite of what I personally respond well to that I was just kind of like, it became such a joke. It was like, okay, I'm gonna be really busy and weak over here. Oh, look at me being weak here. And, yeah. You know, and some people, they, you know, they like the military boot camp shouting approach and like, I'm just not a shouter. That's not for me. And you know, there's so many options out there that people can find something that works for them. And that's an amazing thing, and that's a beautiful thing that there's just these. And now we're in this time of age of athleticism where, you know, people are moving more, they're moving full body, and the neuroscience that's coming out about movement, the biotensegrity fascia work that's coming out about movement, like all of this is just connecting all the dots together. And it's kind of like, I think, you know, parkour movement, like we're lucky, we've been doing it right for years, and it'll continue to serve us well, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're coming up on an hour here, and so I want to end by telling people where to learn more about you. But first, I want to ask one more practical question. That's just for anybody who's been listening to this, who has not done parkour and is intrigued, they want to learn more. What do you recommend for somebody who wants to get started? What would be a smart way to go about that?
I mean, ideally, there's nothing like firsthand, you know, in-person experience. So, you know, go online, Google your area and the word parkour and see if there is a gym, see if there is a coach, go and speak to them, speak to the person who's running it and speak to the coaches. And if you have a good connection, a good feeling, go and learn from them. There is actually a really nice online course that the guys from Apex Movement put together called Parkour 101. So there is a kind of online option there. Go outside and remember what it was like with your childlike eyes. Go outside and remember, I used to go across those rocks. I used to step up onto that little small wall and walk along that. I used to think of ways that you can test and challenge your ability in a way that's really safe for you to start. So, I mean, stay low and stay slow and, you know, draw a line on the pavement or put a leaf on the grass and go, okay, I'm going to jump from here to here, you know, 50 times, landing perfectly in balance. Find things to balance on. Find, you know, even if you're just walking and you think like, okay, I'm just going to duck under that railing and then I'm going to see if I can come back over it. Regain this childlike vision of opportunity. I think is my advice as far as kind of sweeping generalist statements around how to start parkour. I mean, a coach is always best, but it's not to say, you know, there's a lot of really great free content online. American Parkour has a really nice PDF on how to start parkour. Apex Movement has really nice content on if you're kind of at like a you have a good kind of physical condition already. I have an online course called Strong Body, Strong Mind. And this will give you a great physical and mental foundation to start parkour. It's going to work on balance, stability, posture, mobility, squat, and basic ideas around strength. So, so Strong Body, Strong Mind is for me. And also because even if someone is like, okay, well, I do CrossFit and I go to the gym and I do this, I actually don't have a great experience with seeing a lot of those people with any functional sense of movement. Being a mover is different than being someone who can lift something up and put it down and do something with a lot of effort in a lot of repetitions. That doesn't translate to movement quality. So these basic foundations of breathing, posture, balance, mobility, squat and strength is a foundation like we can never do enough of. So for me, those are the starting points for parkour.
That's all excellent advice. And I encourage anybody watching this, check out Julie's course. And please, can you tell us like the best places to find more information about you, your websites, and just wherever you are online?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. So the main kind of, I have two websites. So if you're interested in my film work and the book, you can check out julieangel.com. And but where I'm putting my kind of energy and focus and projects and for people to learn things, you want to go to the See and Do website, which is see-do.com. So see-do.com. And you'll find access to the online course. If you want to read inspiring blogs about women in their 50s doing parkour or intergenerational training, different ideas, adventures I've had in movement, that's the place to go. And also in the next month or so, I'm hoping to release a free mini course called Move More. And I just share different ideas of different systems. I mean, through the filmmaking, I've had access to some quite interesting and varied movers and disciplines and ideas. So I needed inspiration and ideas and someone to kind of invite me to start moving more in my life. And my life is, you know, the more you move, the better you feel. And I think we should all have that and feel better. So when that's up and running, I'd be very happy to share that with your listeners as well.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it. So Julie, thank you very much for your time today. We covered a lot, and I thank you for being so open and sharing so much. I really enjoyed the interview. And I've got a lot more questions about MoveNat, so if you're open to it, I'd love to do a part two someday and talk about MoveNat and, you know, some of the other stuff that you do. So that invitation is always there if you're interested.
Oh, that would be a pleasure. Yeah, we'd be very happy to. So thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely.
All right.
All right. Take care, Julie. I'll be in touch soon.
Thank you.
All
thank
right.
you. Have a great day.
Thanks,
take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.